Hi there. Welcome to another episode of the Customer-Led Groove Show, where we discuss and share the best practices and the latest trends in customer marketing, advocacy, and customer-led growth. Today's episode is brought to you by BASE, a pioneer in B2B marketing and the industry's first CLG ecosystem for customer-led marketers, sales, and product professionals. Okay, let's welcome the CLG team and today's guests.
Welcome to another episode of Customer-Led Groove, orchestrated by BASE. I'm Scott Wilder, and today we're with Jim Lien. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Anyway, so Jim and I met at a BASE meetup in Denver, where I used to live in Denver, and it was a great conversation. And Jim basically took all of us through, Jim basically discussed with us, how do you conduct customer interviews? And I think all of us are in these customer-facing roles, and we never really step back and think about what's the proper way to interview somebody, right? We kind of either jump into it or we just have our list of questions and we don't really think about like how to prepare mentally for it and some other tips that Jim is going to share with us. But before we get into that, you should know about Jim. He spent 20 years or has been at Oracle for 20 years, which is quite impressive. And when I read his LinkedIn profile, it said he's a customer advocate, listener, writer, storyteller, but it did not say that he is on ski patrol. Right, Jim?
Yeah, I try and work that into every conversation, but no, it's not on my LinkedIn profile.
Okay, well, I wish you put it there because that's some added value today. We might talk to you a little bit about, since we have some snowstorms going on around the country, maybe you can give us some tips.
There's actually something, something relevant about that to what we're talking about. There's actually something relevant.
Yeah. Cool.
We'll get to that.
Just a quick story here about, or just tell us quickly about, you know, you've been at Oracle for 20 years, which to be honest, I don't know anybody who's done anything for 20 years. I've only been married for 15 years, so I haven't even gotten to that milestone. But how have you like survived at Oracle? And to also tell us the different roles you've played there.
Yeah, I came to Oracle via the J.D. Edwards PeopleSoft acquisitions, and I joined there kind of really coincidentally when I got my master's degree in the evenings while working as a corporate sales rep. But the first 10 years I was in traditional product marketing roles, and then I was involved in setting up and running the first SMB marketing group at Oracle. And after we moved to cloud, then I did sales enablement in our Oracle Digital Sales Centers around the globe, teaching young people how to engage and interact with financial professionals. And then 3 years ago, I got moved into customer marketing. And since that happened, I've been really focused on interviewing, writing customer success stories, and kind of mentoring my colleagues in the same. As far as surviving goes, what I would say, first of all, it's pretty simple. It's to me, it was deciding what was important to me and letting nothing get in the way of that. And then I think the reason that I keep getting these interesting roles is because I have, everybody has superpowers and I leverage mine. And my two superpowers are writing, which has a lot of skills that go along with that. And live presentations. I love to be on a stage. I love to, for lack of a better term, perform in front of audiences, right? And those two superpowers have allowed me to always be in what I consider to be interesting roles at Oracle. I've never been bored.
That's awesome. Like, I think it's amazing because, you know, once you're bored, then it's time to try something different.
I can't imagine. And you know, thankfully, I've always had great relationships with my managers, and they've wanted me to be in those roles. You know, I built relationships with them, and I've been genuine. I think I've told you before that I'm the same person at work as I am at home, and no one ever wonders if I'm putting on some sort of facade. And that's helped me with my managers, and they've always wanted me to be in positions that I enjoy.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about what you described as the 9 key steps to customer interviews. Why don't you take us through these 9 steps?
Yeah. And the funny thing is about it, you know, some of these I would think some people might say, duh, Captain, you know, duh, Captain Obvious. Of course, these are things you have to do. But I can tell you, even though I wrote these, and I wrote these based on 30 years of experience, back to my sales days, right? But I review my own 9 steps to better interviews all the time because I don't want to take anything for granted. And for a great example is tip number two, but number one is be intellectually curious. And I sometimes describe myself as the most intellectually curious person you'll ever meet in your life. I cannot sit next to someone without observing them and wanting to ask them questions. You know, why are they wearing that? You know, those shoes don't match what they're doing. Why are they wearing those shoes, right? And so what I do is I apply that to every customer story I go into, right? I look at it and go, what is the theme? Suss out what the theme is. And everything I do, all my curiosity is directed towards that theme and in support of that theme. That's number one. Secondly, is the Captain Obvious of do your homework. And that means learning everything that your company knows about that customer before you go into the interview. And in smaller companies, I think that's easier. But in a company like Oracle, that's known for our databases, right? We have such vast amounts of knowledge and they're not all in one place, right? So doing that due diligence, and I usually spend, you know, a couple hours on that part of it. And then I go out to LinkedIn. I study the person on LinkedIn. I've studied you on LinkedIn. Everybody that I interact, I will go study them on a LinkedIn. And then I'll use Oracle DataFox service to go in and look for trends and, you know, put in the search field certain things about that customer, the person, the customer, company, and see what they have to know, right? Or what I can learn on DataFox about them, trends and whatnot. And then when you're going into number three is when you're going into the interview itself, setting that up in advance. We usually like to have discovery calls. They aren't always with the individual themselves, but they are with someone who has contact with that individual. So I like to set expectations, right? And the first part about that is I've learned is executives don't like to be surprised. And at Oracle, I've got to the level where every day, everything I do, I interact with someone VP level or above. And it's like, I've learned certain things you don't say, certain things you don't do. And most and foremost, you know, they don't want to be surprised, especially in real time, right? You don't want to see that look of surprise on their face, right? And what I do that, as far as setting it up, I like to use a conversation framework rather than a list of questions. Now, I will say moving into the tech side of things, I was in the app side for 22 years, and now I've been in the tech side for a little while. And we do have to have more robust interview guides on the tech side, right? So but normally I like to just provide a framework up front and then have a conversation with the person because I've done all my homework and I use these other skills I talk about. Then it's just going to be a conversation like we're having right now, right? That's number three. So setting the right expectations. And number four is, yeah, go ahead.
Let me ask a question here. So you said some really interesting things. So do's and don'ts when talking to the VP level and above. I think we had somebody on here earlier, Peter from the Next CMO, who really provided coaching on how to prepare to present to the C level. And I think that's really key. So, you know, he's really.
I'll look at that one.
Yes. And so I think it'd be really interesting if you could just, you know, off the top of your head, say, here are like 2 or 3 things you should do when you interview a C level person. And here are two or three things you should stay away from.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is I hope that people, like you alluded to the ski patrol thing. If someone was going to interview me and saw that I have ski patrol on my LinkedIn profile, that tells me something about what's important to that person. And just about everybody will put something out there, whether it's charitable organizations or whether it's their alma mater, right? And I get a sense right there for what's important to them, right? And then you look at their background and you see something like, well, this person originally got a degree in broadcast, and somehow they're in product development, right? And you look at their college experience, you look at their first jobs, and you're like, well, this person is not going to be the typical person. I'm not going to make assumptions about this person, right? That'd be the first thing. Don't make assumptions about them. And if you don't make assumptions, then, but if you get a wealth of knowledge from doing that, that helps you. If you don't get a lot of knowledge from that, then you're going to be wary. You know, you're going to be more wary. And you're also going to get a sense in my discovery calls with people who know them. I'll actually ask them the question, what is their demeanor? Right? Are they friendly? Do they like to talk? Do they like to put you in their place? Do they like to, brag? Do they like to boast about their accomplishments? And that's what's really important to get an idea of what their personality is. Since you're going to be having a conversation and it's going to be on Zoom nowadays, you want to know about their personality and what's important to them.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. You know, today it was really interesting. I had a business meeting, and within 10 minutes, the guy said to me, "I understand that you studied Asian studies in graduate school." I'm like, whoa. So that guy did his research, because there's only one small place you can find that on my LinkedIn profile. And so he actually scrolled down. I think that's another tip. Scroll down.
Scroll down. Absolutely. That stuff's at the bottom. It's absolutely at the bottom. Right.
Yeah.
And then a follow-up question to you would be, how did you go from Asian studies to what you do now? And that's where you hear some great stories.
Yep. Yep. We'll save that story for later on.
I interview you.
The other thing that really resonated with me is this intellectual curiosity, which is, it's funny you say that, because that's something that I personally always aspire to have. And I say aspire to have it. Intuit, for example, the head of HR has told me that one of the things they look for is the curiosity quotient, the CQ. It's really nice. So. Anyway, I just wanted to share that. So how about getting back to these 9 points of
life?
Well,
that's a great segue, because number four is to have a personal brand. And this is especially hard for people who are less experienced or younger. You know, it's easy to be intimidated and to be starstruck. You know, I've interviewed some, top-level executives at some very large companies. And it would be very easy for me to go in there and be intimidated, right? But the very fact that that person has agreed to talk to you and be interviewed by you means that they see some value in that conversation, right? Unless they're just egomaniacs who just want someone to dote on them, right? But it means, like, I'm willing to talk to this person, right? And you should always remember that, because if they're your customer, or they're in your industry, or they're in your circle, then you have something that they probably want to know, right? And back when I was doing sales enablement, I would always tell them to have a research report, proprietary research report in your hand that might be appropriate to that person, and say, hey, after this conversation, I'm going to send you this report because I learned in this report that 67% of this does that, right? And the other thing would be, if you're interviewing people for a living, you are gathering information. Every interview I have, I reference another interview. You did that in this conversation, right? So you have the benefit of having repeated conversations with people like the person you're interviewing. So share that information with them, right? Tell them something they probably don't know. Now, again, you got to be careful that you don't assume that they don't know it. And this goes back to things like man speak, right? Don't talk in that tone like you know something that they don't. Don't assume you know something that they don't, right? So, like, when I walk up to a campfire with my guitar, and I'm not a very good guitar player, when I walk up to people at a campfire and they all look at me expectantly because I have a guitar in my hand, I look at them and I hold the guitar out and I say, "Does anybody know how to use this?" And the response you get, laughter always. Sometimes, it's 4 or 5 times it's happened to me where some guy goes, "Well, I used to play." And they'll pull the guitar out and then they'll shred. And it's like, good thing I knew that before I just started playing guitar. So you don't want to assume they don't know what you're about to tell them, but you can easily couch that by saying something like, "Well, you may know this, but 67% of this does, right?" So bring them something. Have a brand. Assume that they want to speak to you and don't be starstruck, right? And number five is be purposeful with your pleasantries. And that involves like reading the room, looking at people's backgrounds, getting a sense for how much they want to chit chat, how much they want to get down to business, right? But you don't want to just launch into a set of questions. You know, you want to at least establish some little set of pleasantries, because I've been on too many interviews where the customer, not, of course, not the interviews I did, but where the customer actually says, boy, this feels kind of like an interrogation. I've heard that a dozen times. And it's because people who have, you know, they've got, I got 12 questions to ask. I got to get through these 12 questions. It's 22 minutes after the hour. I got 8 minutes left. I got 6 more questions to go. Rapid fire, rapid fire, rapid fire. No, no. I mean, never do that, right? And part of the pleasantries also is introducing everybody that's on the call. And someone gave me this tip yesterday that sometimes I like to, you know, the internal people, I like to tell them in advance, this is the way I conduct the interview, but you don't always get that chance. So what you do is you say that to the person you're interviewing. You say, Scott, here's the way this interview goes, you know, and you tell them that I'm going to be going through these questions. After each section, I'll give Dan and Melissa a chance to ask questions. So you're telling Dan and Melissa right there, they're going to have their chance. And you're in the underlying thing there is saying to Dan and Melissa, don't interrupt me, right? So you're telling Scott, hey, Scott, Dan and Melissa are going to have a chance. But the under, you know, if those people are reading the room, they're going like, oh, Jim just told me not to interrupt him, right? Although interruptions are okay in certain situations, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing about pleasantries is this is the hidden, one of the hidden questions is that I don't put it on the interview guide, but when I start asking questions, the first thing I say is, Scott, tell me, what would you like this story to be about? And they always look up at the ceiling 100% of the time. They go, oh, wow, you know, I think what I want this story to be about is the tremendous effort and accomplishment my team has accomplished, right? And it's just fun to get there. And a lot of times that's the theme. Right. So it's just fun to get their off the cuff from their gut feeling about what the theme for the story should be about. Does that make sense?
Makes total sense. And I love the idea of asking them what they want it to be about versus just, you know, just jumping right into the conversation. And also another thing, what I'm observing here as I'm learning from you is the stories you're weaving in this with the guitar and things like that. I wrote down a musical way to break bread.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And, you know, something like playing guitar at a campfire is a gathering thing. It's the way people, you know, they get to know each other, right? And if you do anything like that, any situation like that, if you enter it into it the right way, you know, you might have people be thinking, I want to talk to this person again, you know? And that was an interesting conversation, and I want to talk to that person again.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of happened with us, you know? I mean, I was listening to you in Denver at this, you know, at this meetup, and I was like, I want to talk to that guy again.
Yeah, I met some amazing people at that meetup, and I want to do that again, but you know, I got follow-ups with 2 or 3 people from that, right?
That's awesome.
I'm giving comp tickets to Michael or McCall, however he says his name, if I remember. Does he say it, McCall? Michael, right?
Yeah,
I've given him comp tickets to London. And I'm going to do another podcast with someone else from that meetup. But yeah, that's a great outcome to an interview is that person walks away, he's growing up. I'd like to talk to that person again.
Yep. Yep.
So number 6 is about listening, right? And listening is a really misconstrued topic because most people think you're either a listener or you're a talker. And what I say is listening is an acquired skill. You know, some people have a gift for listening, but the other thing I always like to say is just because you're not talking doesn't mean you're listening, right? So active listening is a skill that you develop. And if you're doing active listening right, you're picking up on cues and you're asking probing questions. You know, it's always okay to interrupt if you're asking for some more detail on their response, right? But you can't be thinking about what the next question you're going to ask is, right? You can't be going like, oh, Scott's answering this question. My next question's this. You know, because if you're not doing that, then you're not going to be able to ask the follow-up probe.
I think that listening part is really key because the person you're interviewing will be able to tell if you're not listening. Like they'll, you know, I think most of the times they'll sense like, okay, this guy is just like, it's a transactional thing. They just want to, they have the box they need to check.
Yeah. And by the way, they're related to that. A lot of times when I'm interviewing someone, I might be looking something up on my other screen. Right. And suddenly my focus is like this. And if I'm doing that, I say to them, oh, by the way, I'm just looking up, you know, autonomous database. That's a really interesting topic. Tell me more about that. So if I turn my attention away, I tell them why I turned my attention away. Because you're exactly right. You know when I'm listening and when I'm not listening, right? And talk about things not to do with an executive is give them the impression that you're not listening, right? That could come back and hurt you. You know, that could go up the line and come back down through your channel and, you know, be a career limiting move. This guy was interviewing me and he was like, looked like he was watching YouTube on another screen. No, he wasn't watching YouTube. He was looking up something about what you just told him. Right. And actually that's again, a segue to number 7 is keep your customer comfortable, is that you got to strive to always make them look and sound good. And I think I told you in Denver about when I was interviewing a CIO of a $3 billion food products distributor, I asked him a question about whether they were doing rolling forecasts with our planning and budgeting solution, because we were talking about planning and budgeting. And he got this look in his eye, and the sales rep was on the call, right? And he looks over at in. Kind of looks at her and looks back at me. He goes, I don't really know, but we'd have to talk to him. And I'm like, oh my God, I just made it. And he had a strong ego. And I thought, oh my God, I just made him uncomfortable because I asked him a question that he didn't know anything about. And I remember that like it was yesterday. And so it's always like, I'm not going to ask them a question that's out of their area of expertise unless we covered that question in the discovery call and we know that they have an answer for it. Right. You know, whether they have an ego or not, you're going to always want to make them look and sound good. And so number 8 is just reiterate clearly what's going to happen next, right? And say it's going to take this much time. You're going to get a chance to review the material. You'll hear from this person, and I'll check in with you a couple weeks just to make sure that we're on track, right? And that's under the old adage of tell people what you're going to do, do it, and then tell them what you just did, right? And then number 9, go ahead.
I was going to say, I call that the say-do ratio.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Right. And it seems that's another Captain Obvious thing. But if you don't do that, you're going to get off that interview call and someone's going to ping you right away and say, what's the next steps? If you didn't cover it in your call. Right. And then, so number 9 is enjoy the ride. You know, people enjoy having conversations with people who are confident and energetic and interesting. So if you're not having fun doing an interview, I mean, good grief, it's such a privilege for most people to be able to do those interviews. And if you're not having fun doing it, then you really need to consider whether there's something else you should be doing with your life, right?
I think the privilege part is really key. And I think that's a kind of frame of mind to go into these things. I mean, obviously you can't force it, but to know that, you know, this is an opportunity to learn and you're learning from somebody else's journey or somebody else's experience.
Yeah. And you can be very genuine in saying that to the person you're interviewing. You know, I worked with another person years ago, not too long ago, who handled setting things up with like CEOs of multi-billion dollar customers, right? And that person's approach was to really flatter them. You know, that person had an incredible brand of their own, but when they interacted with executives, they would just flatter them, right? And sometimes you have to do that. But for me, that's just not natural for me. It's not genuine, right? And so what I will say though is, God, I feel really privileged and honored to get to talk to you today because I've been wanting to have this conversation this conversation for a long time. And that's genuine, right? And if, again, if you say that to them, they're going to appreciate that, right? And, that's part of being, enjoying what you're doing. And I tell you, I get to my wife, every time I do an interview, I'll go over to her and I'll say something like, did you know that 70% of the Indian workforce rely on instant personal loans to make purchases such as wedding gifts? And, you know, it's like whatever I learned in that interview, I'll give her like the theme. I'll just be like, I can't believe I just learned this today about the instant loan industry in India, right? So it is a privilege, and not many people have the opportunity to not only have that interaction, but also learn something that's outside their comfort zone every time they do an interview.
Yeah. It's funny. At Intuit, we used to say, learn, teach, learn. And that's how you learn things. But maybe it should be learn, share, learn.
Well, what do you think happens as soon as you share it? Someone tells you about that, something about that same thing that you didn't know.
It sinks in more, right? It's kind of like when you share something, your example there. I mean, you've kind of brought it in, you've thought about it, you've processed it. When you share it with somebody else or you repeat it, it just gets even more reinforced.
Yeah, that we have a famous saloon here in my little town where on the picture, there's hundreds of photographs of people who have played there. One of whom was Greg Allman. When, after the Allman Brothers broke up, that's a long story, but he parked his bus in front of that saloon and he played that saloon. And when my band was playing there, I would say to the audience, what an honor it is to be standing on the same stage as Greg Allman did. And I'll point to his picture. And I told that story at my local pub one night, and the wife of one of my friends looks at me. She goes, I was bartender that night. And she proceeded to tell me the story of Greg Allman playing the Little Bear Saloon, right? And I retell that story now all the time. And once a year, she recertifies me on telling the story of that night. I literally once a year have her make sure that I'm telling that story correctly. So she took my story of playing the stage that Greg Allman did, that me actually being able to tell people about the night Greg Allman played that same stage and stood where I stood. So yeah, you share that and boom, you learn something more.
Awesome.
What number are we at now? That was 9, but I do have a bonus tip.
Go for it.
The unexpected question. And what I've been doing recently, when I talk about the challenge, because you're always asking people what the challenge is, and they're prepared to tell you about the challenges. They say, we did this, we did that, we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that. And after they tell me that, then I say, how did that make you feel, Scott? And you're going to go, well, I lost a lot of sleep. What was the impact on your team? Oh, I got to tell you, Jim, we were working nights and weekends. Morale was down. You know, and again, they haven't prepared for that response. They're just telling you their gut response. And then after they tell you what the results were, then you go, yeah, based on those results, Scott, how do you feel now? I'll tell you, Jim, I'm sleeping. And you know what else? I had an employee come up to me and we had this guy who before we had this was just another guy. We put this modern solution in place and all of a sudden it was like he had an epiphany and he is one of my best people now. You know, and they just tell you those stories off the top of their head. They're not going to tell you that in the interview guide. But if you come in and ask that unexpected gem, then you might get some really great responses. That's my bonus tip.
I love it.
And it's not the tip. Yeah, because you want an odd number in a list. So you can't have 10. Only 10's not a bad number, but I always try and have an odd number in my list.
Nice, nice. Well, we're almost at time here, but I have two bonus questions to ask you.
Awesome. Hey, they weren't on the guide, Scott.
So the first one was, is there anything that you thought about while we were talking that I didn't ask you? And you're like, damn, Wilder, why didn't you ask me that?
No, I think you've done a great job of interviewing because we had a lot of material to get through. So you knew you couldn't. In this situation, you and I couldn't interact as much because I got to get through my 9 tips, right? So I just think that you handle that really well.
It's tough to be, you know, when I'm interviewing the interview whisperer here. And then I'm just curious, you know, who or what has influenced you the most? And when I say who, it could be somebody in your professional life. It could be somebody you meet there on the mountain, or what could be a book or an experience, like the woman in the who worked in the pub or the bar where Greg Allman was.
There are two things that really influenced me the most. The first is that I was born into poverty. I didn't feel like I was born into poverty, but we were subsistence farmers in Minnesota. First 9 years of my life, we did not have running water. We couldn't heat the upper level of the house in the winter. I didn't know we were poor until like when I was in second grade and some kid in third grade said to me, "I don't like you." And I say, "Why don't you like me?" And they said, "Because you wear the same shirt to school every day." And I didn't know until that moment in time that we were poor. Right. So I always keep that in mind. And the other thing that really influenced me was I was successful right out of college selling computers to banks. And then I moved out to Colorado to be a ski bum. And when I was 27 years old, due to a series of events, I lost both my jobs and I couldn't afford my apartment anymore. And I was living in the mountains of Colorado. And from like the 1st of June until the middle of September, I was homeless and unemployed and living in a car in the mountains, right? So my view of the world is shaped by those two things. Right? Don't get above your raisins, right? I mean, I was poor. I came from very humble background. I was successful and then I was homeless, right? So when am I ever going to judge anything about anybody, right? And if you don't go into a situation judging, then you're going to be open to, you know, hearing more and being open-minded. Right. You're not just going to look at a person and say, "I know what their story is," because you can't look at me and know my story. Right. Mm-hmm. So those are the two things that I would say really influence the way I operate more than anything.
Those are really special. Cause I personally wrestle with not judging people. Right. So you hear how you approach it. Is really, helpful for me to hear. And so,
you have that top influencer badge, right? You know, that you have on your LinkedIn profile. You're a top influencer. Someone sees that, like, this dude, the top influencer, right? And you make a lot of assumptions off of that, right? It could be an assumption that he's not going to be interested in hearing what I have to say. Because, by the way, when I post something on LinkedIn, I get 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 likes. And then I decided to start posting videos from my travels around the world as an Oracle sales enablement guy. Suddenly, I'm getting 40, 50 likes, right? Me riding a bike down by the San Francisco airport, you know, me skiing in Dubai, right? Nothing to do with work except I'm on a work trip, right? And then my favorite one is I was on ski patrol one day and I post this thing. I go, "I'm so lucky to work for a company that allows me to have a side gig like this." And it's a 3-minute video of a porcupine at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, walking up the ski slope from a tree towards, an on mountain lodge. And it's like 3 minutes of a porcupine walking up a snowy ridge. I got like 60, 70, 80 likes on LinkedIn. So I go, what does that tell me about the world we're living in now? And that tells me that people want to bring the human element into what we do, period. My boss's boss's boss will like those videos. I checked. My boss's boss's boss liked the porcupine video, liked the video of me riding a bike to light rail to go to open world, you know? So it's like, don't make the assumption because you're a top influencer that you're unapproachable, right?
I think you just gave us number 11.
Well, that's an odd number, so I'm okay with that.
Okay, phew. Well, Jim, this has been great. I really appreciate your time, and I know it's a busy time of year. Is there any last
things you want to share with folks, how they can find you, where they can, you know, I know someday, I'm telling you, someday you should write a book about this or a video series or something. Where can they find you?
I would love it if people engage with me on LinkedIn, but do it in a manner that doesn't make me think they want to sell me something, right? Because I've quit accepting LinkedIn connections because I look at what they do and I go, I think the next, as soon as I accept, the next thing they're going to do is ask me to buy something, right? That goes back to being genuine, right? Genuinely reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect.
Awesome. Well, thank you everybody for joining us today. This has been Customer Led Groove. And by the way, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, Google, and Alexa. If I say what that spells, she'll ask me a question. So Alexa. And by the way, everybody always says, you know, like us or like me on these podcast networks. That's not what I'm going to say. I always end by saying, just listen and then play it forward and share it with somebody else. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining Customer Led Groove. Remember, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and on the CLG campus. Feel free to rate us, follow us, and leave a comment on any of those platforms. We hope to see you again soon when we're back in the Customer Led Groove.